Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Willow, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro, and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. In studio, I have Julian Coriel and an interesting musician. As tonight, we're going to talk mainly about guitar, but he's a multi-instrumentalist and a vocalist. And I think that's important because it does influence how he plays and how he phrases. So we're going to get into that. Also joining me is Lori Reamer. It's good to have you back from China.
Thank you. I am back.
But let me start out real quick. Let's just get right into it. I'm going to play a clip to kind of give you an idea. This is an older clip from his album Jazzbo. And it's just it's a great fusion. He's cranking away. This is called Flim Flam on the Shim Sham. Take a listen. Welcome to the show, Julian. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. Great to be here.
And let's get a little bit into your background. You have a very interesting musical background. You didn't start on guitar. If I'm correct, you started on piano at a very early age. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I was about four or five, and my dad's a musician, a guitar player. Listeners may know him. His name is Larry Coriel. And so there was always musical instruments around the house growing up. And so we had a drum kit and a piano and guitars kind of lying around. And I just kind of gravitated towards piano and drums when I was about four or five. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of my way in to instruments.
Now, the what were your early influences? What were you listening to? I mean, obviously, your dad was. You probably heard a lot of music from him at the home. But, I mean, what else were you listening to? What you consider major influences?
On guitar?
Yeah, guitar in general, I mean.
Because they're very specific. The guitar influences and the non-guitar influences, they're very specific and they're very different. But, I mean, I didn't actually start playing guitar seriously till I was about 15 or so, because the pressure that I felt to be a Coriel and pick up a guitar was just really too much for me.
Mm-hmm.
So until I was 15, I played everything else. And the last instrument I played before I played guitar was bass. And that seemed to work out well because my dad actually started to let me do gigs with him. And I thought, okay, this is going to work out well for me. I'll play bass with him, and maybe one day I'll get to be his bass player for the long haul. And then when I was about 15, I just realized, you know, I'm not really a bass player. I'm a guitarist. I just have to deal with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Which was not easy, but I accepted that, and I accept it to this day, and it is still the cross I have to bear. But, you know, as far as influences on guitar, they are really too numerous to mention the complete list. But, yeah, my father is definitely the primary because he was the one that was right in front of me. But when I started getting really serious about guitar, it was in the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guys that were kind of new and exciting for me, and they, some of them had been around for a while, some of them were kind of cutting edge at the time, but like Scott Henderson mm-hmm. was my big hero. I had heard him play with Jeff Berlin and Chick Corea, and I'd never heard anyone do that on guitar before him.
Mm-hmm.
And I still haven't, to be honest. I mean, I love Scott, and I still... If he's playing in L.A. and I'm not working, I'll go see him play, and I still get my mind blown. He was just a massive, important influence on me. But and then sort of the related string of heroes around him and that scene, you know, Alan Holdsworth. And
mm-hmm.
But, of course, it was the 80s, so there was a lot of shredding going on, and so I was not immune to that. And so you had guys like Paul Gilbert and... the great Sean Lane, who's very, still kind of underground, but, you know, he passed away many years ago, but
mm-hmm.
incredible. But the list just really, it just goes on and on. I mean, when I got a little bit older, the three M's were sort of my my food for jazz guitar, which was like Montgomery, Martino, and Matheny. And those are the guys that I really sort of got drawn into. Actually, Wes later, but Matheny was definitely on the radar. And
so you, I mean, it's obvious because of your dad that yeah. you would have a very strong jazz influence, yeah. but it's interesting what you're mentioning because you were in, being from the 80s, you got into a lot of the shredder guys,
sure.
but nobody in the blues, I mean, I'm sure you listened to everything, but was like the early blues, like a lot of the 60s or 70s musicians, was that an influence at all? Or
well, I have an older brother, his name is Morali, and he's an incredible guitarist and singer as well, but he ended up being the blues guy, so I would come home, he's a few years older than me, and he was actually my musical teacher when I was a kid because he had the great record collection, and he got into blues in his teens, and so I kind of rebelled because you don't want to do what your siblings are doing, you want to individuate, right? But I heard all that stuff, and he, you know, he was playing B.B. King live at the Regal, and All the kings, you know, mm-hmm. Freddie and Albert and BB. And it's funny because he started with Stevie Ray, like a lot of, I think, suburban white boys did, you know. We started with Stevie Ray. And we all thought Stevie Ray was kind of the white man's blues guitarist. And mm-hmm. we didn't take him as seriously. And then, of course, all these years later, you know, with the benefit of hindsight and taste, you realize that he was just phenomenally good. But at the time, just to be honest with you,
mm-hmm.
a lot of us thought Stevie Ray was sort of like, well, this is the blues guitarist for white people. You know?
Mm-hmm.
If you're really serious about blues, you need to listen to Blind Lemon Jefferson, and you need to listen to you know, Buddy Guy and all the kings. And
you know, so your brother was a purist. He listened to the original.
He started with Stevie Ray and very soon moved, you know, deeper down the well.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
to this day, he's like an authority on that stuff. It's incredible. I can call him up. You know, we talk about Magic Sam, and we'll talk about Shake, Rattle, and Roll. I forget the guy's name now who did that, Shake, Rattle, and Roll. I draw a blank because there's so many of these guys. But
I'm not thinking of it myself.
Yeah, but, you know, oh, man. See, I draw a blank with all these blues guys, but Guys like Magic Sam and people like that we'll talk about, and he knows all that stuff, and I'll go to him and he'll have all the answers. So yeah, the blues was there, but honestly, I didn't get the blues thing till later. I'm really starting to understand how incredible those musicians are. But when I was a teenager, man, it really was just all chops and no taste.
Well, I mean, you, from listening, even...
Elvin Bishop, that's the guy I'm thinking of. Incredible, incredible.
Yeah, he's a great musician.
Yeah, unbelievable.
But it's interesting because in some of the clips that I'm going to play, you really have the rock thing down, and you really... It's tasty. You're doing tasteful leads, and it's very melodic. It's not just... I mean, you're playing fast, but it has melody and it has purpose to it. And I think that, you know, for a guy that really wasn't focusing on that, you do it really well.
Thanks.
And then you also did some other interesting stuff, too, that I noticed when I was reading, and I pulled some clips for that, and we're going to play that in a little bit. You did a Japanese rock opera, if I'm correct. Is it the Gaijin is the rock opera?
Yeah, Gaijin. Yeah.
Gaijin.
Yeah. I lived in Japan off and on for several years. I was playing with a Japanese rock star over there, and I still play with him from time to time. I love him. His name is Yoshi Kazuya. Mm-hmm. And he had a band called the Yellow Monkey, which was sort of Japan's version of Oasis. Massive band. And, you know, amongst other things, I'm a session guitarist here in L.A., so I get random calls to play on lots of records, and I got recommended to play on his album, and he liked me, and he asked me on the next record and the next, and about the fourth or fifth record in, he said, "Why don't you go on tour with me?" I said, "Well, maybe we should try this, because I've played on all your records." And so I was living in Japan working with him, and I felt an incredible amount of alienation being this American, and Japan is at an extremely homogeneous nation. You know, it's not the great melting pot that America is. And so if you stay for an extended period, you will most likely feel some sort of isolation if you don't speak the language. And so I just got very fed up with that, and necessity invented this rock opera. I said, well, what if I write this story about these two foreigners that come to Japan? You know, one has good intentions and the other has not so good intentions, and they both fall in love with the same Japanese girl. What would happen if I wrote that story and set it to music? So that's what that is. Mm-hmm. Gaijin.
And well, Gaijin means barbarian, if I'm correct.
It means outside person.
Oh, okay.
It means outside person. So when you and I and Lori go to Japan, we are Gaijin. Mm-hmm. We're the outside people. And depending on who calls you that, and how sensitive you are or are not, it's either seen as something that means nothing to you or it can be very offensive. And so I had a translator that they assigned me, and we would go to the restaurants, and I would practice my Japanese. I was teaching myself Japanese because I could not stand the being shut out. You know, it's fine for a few days, but, you know, you're there for months at a time. You cannot speak to people in their mother tongue. It's very difficult. So I would start to practice that Japanese, teach myself Japanese, and she would always refer to the other guys in the band who are Japanese by their names. And then when she would order for me at dinner or something, she would always say, and the Gaijin would like some steak, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, you know, Jungo and Takashi and so on, they, you know, they would like some chicken, and the Gaijin over here wants some steak. And I just remember thinking, do you not understand that I am here in front of you and you're... This is deeply offensive to me. And so Gaijin is an outside person, and that, I very much felt that the longer I was there. And so that's what that
especially that I know from working with Japanese people. I worked at Panasonic. The language is so different. I mean, even in Europe, you can feel isolated because you don't understand, but there's still relatable words because there's a crossover.
Yeah.
So you can kind of get around, and people do speak English, but there is, you can kind of figure it out. But when you're looking at characters, you have no idea. I totally get that.
Yeah, and you know, most Americans have some contact with Romance languages. Mm-hmm. And so even if you find yourself in, you know, France or Spain or even Germany, you can kind of fib your way through a lot of stuff. But Japan really is like, it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
And also culturally, it's very different. And that was really... You know, the language was the surface, but you scratch that surface, the culture is really what will befuddle you if you try to figure it out. And I think one of the residual effects was I'm much kinder to foreigners in the States now. especially, you know, Japanese people that come over here and they have to work here for an extended period of time and they don't really know the language, I'm much more empathy for them because, man, it is hard.
Yeah.
It is hard to be a stranger in a strange land.
Yeah, no, and it was funny because even they, like, trying to explain them slang, which as Americans, English is 90% slang here.
Yeah.
It's not really as formal as like in England or something like that. So it drives them nuts because they just don't understand at all. But one other thing, I'm going to play a clip from Gaijin, Tokyo Boundo, and what I noticed in that album is you got that sound that they had. I've listened to a lot of music. I'm a big fan of anime and some of the composers from over there. So I'm going to play the clip, and then I want to talk about the style and how you incorporated that, because it's obviously an album with a very Japanese influence. To me, it sounds like it.
Oh, yeah.
So, okay, let's play this. This is Tokyo Boundo, and take a listen to this, and we'll be right back. Now, what were you using, before we get into the style, what were you using there, and how did you record that?
Well, I mean, the premise of that story takes place in 1978. So the rule that I set for myself was everything that I used on that record had to have been available in 1978 or thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
So everything on that recording you probably could have found at that time, which is why, hopefully, if I achieve the goal, it sounds authentic. So I think on that, every song on Gaijin is modeled after some famous rock song that was popular in Japan around that time. And so that was, that Tokyo Boundo is, it was sort of inspired by like a Deep Purple kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted to get that sound. And as far as the gear on that, every... I think that's like a, what did I use? Like a 72 Les Paul Custom. Even though, you know, Ritchie Blackmore didn't play a Les Paul Custom. I think he played a Strat, but you certainly would have found a plethora of rock bands in the 70s playing Les Pauls, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so that was sort of the idea. So that was a 72 Les Paul Custom, and I think all the amps on that record were from the 70s as well. So probably on that one was like maybe an old Music Man.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
not a Marshall.
I had I have Marshalls on that record, but I'm trying to remember that particular solo. That might have been through a Marshall actually, because that's kind of a big rock thing. But on a lot of that record, we used old Fenders and old Music Mans.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because we wanted to get that, you know, that feeling. But yeah, that's probably a Marshall on that one.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Now, that Les Paul, I saw some videos of you with the cast.
Mm.
And is that the Les Paul you were using in those?
No, that guitar, the cast guitar, that's called Nadine. And Nadine is on Gaijin, but Nadine is a Wagamama I used Nadine on. Mm-hmm. That's the black Les Paul Custom.
Oh, okay, we'll play that.
Yeah, later. Yeah, but no, this... I mean, I'm splitting hairs, man. I got very obsessive about this record, and Nadine sounded too pretty for Tokyo Boundo. I wanted something that was grittier, a little bit uglier, and so I found this 72 Les Paul Custom. Nadine is a 73 Les Paul Custom. It just happens to have a very classic Les Paul sound, very creamy.
Mm-hmm.
But that other guitar, which I forget its name. I try to name all of them, but that one, oh, Jeffrey, that's right.
Jeffrey's
a little rougher around the edges.
Okay. No relation to me, but I am rough around the edges. That's okay. Let me, I'm going to play, since you mentioned it, I'm going to play Wagamama, a clip from that.
Sure.
And then I want to talk a little bit about the Japanese sound, going into a little more detail of that. So here's Wagamama. We'll be right back. if you're getting that out of a Fender amp and that much distortion cranked, I'm amazed. The gain on that is great. Are you using an overdrive pedal on that?
Yeah, no, that, see, that one, the inspiration was like Elegant Gypsy, like Al Di Meola. And that was intentional. We wanted it to sound like, I think it's a song like Race with the Devil on a Midnight Highway or something. You know, just those those Al Di Meola records from the 70s have a very particular sound. And so I just kind of researched, you know, what he was using. And I wanted to get that flavor. And actually, my dad heard that. And he said, wow, that sounds just like Al Di Meola. That's because I wanted it to. So I was really happy when he said that. Yeah, it worked. But so I used the Black Les Paul, which, you know, Al used that, I remember.
Nadine.
Yeah, that's Nadine. And I'll tell you very specifically how I got that sound, because it took me a long time to figure out how to get it. So it's a Black Les Paul into the original Boss Orange Overdrive distortion. The original Boss distortion. It's just, I think it's called a DS1. And, you know, that's from the 70s as well. Mm-hmm. And you have to get the one with the Japanese chip, not the Taiwan chip, if you want it to sound correct. And then that went into a pedal that simulates a Marshall cabinet. And then that went into a Boogie Mark IV, Mark V. And then you kind of just fiddle with the knobs until you get that sweet spot. And that's it. That's how you get that Di Meola sound.
That's a great sound. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
That's
a... I mean, I was tempted to get off the road there, you know, and just have that be my sound. But I'll tell you this, man. What's the point of sounding great if you just sound like somebody else? And that's the most painful thing for me. Is like, I'll arrive every few years at a great guitar tone, but then I realize quickly thereafter that it's not mine. It's somebody else's. And I have to start over again. I got to let it go, because I'll never have my own voice. But that was a hard one to let go of, because I finally got that Di Meola sound. Yeah. Man, I was so excited.
Well, a lot of it's true. I mean, when you look at all the different amps and the guitars, it's been done.
Oh, yeah.
So you're using the, and there's a reason, you know, I mean, a Les Paul and a Marshall, for example, it has a certain sound, but it's been done
to death.
But I think that what I noticed is in that lead that you played in Wagamama is that you start out and you're playing like a muted thing, and you're doing really light, and it's clean and it's articulate, and then you just whip, and then you go in and you're really wailing. I'm amazed the pedal gets that, because usually that sound to me sounds like the tube's just really going for it.
Yeah.
Well, that sound out of a pedal is amazing.
But the Boogie, you know, does a lot. I mean, that pedal through a solid state amp would not sound like that. It's the combination. That Boss Overdrive, that OD1, is a night and day pedal. You put it through the wrong amp, it just sounds absolutely terrible. Mm-hmm. But you put that pedal through a Marshall with the Marshall distortion, you see, you have to blend them. It sounds phenomenally good, and it sounds like so many famously guitar tones that you've heard. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a lot of the girth of that tone and the saturation is coming from the Boogie, for sure.
But you do you ever use the amp just fully out without the or do you need the overdrive? Because there is a difference.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I lose my mind over this stuff, Jeff. I mean, I've lost my mind many times, and I've come back, and the short answer is it's case by case. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've gone through periods where I've sworn off pedals, and I say I'm only using amp distortion from now on, because that really is the sweetest distortion. But I just did the Riot Fest in Chicago with Dee Schneider, and we're on rented gear, and all my sound comes from my pedal board, because it's just too risky to show up and play through an amp I've never played in front of like 5,000-6,000 people. I'm just not going to do it. So, you know, if I had my druthers, if I had a budget, and when I do have a budget, I always bring the high gain amps and I use their distortion internally. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if it's like a beer budget, then I'm going to bring my pedal boards and I'm going to get the tone from the pedal board.
Right.
Because I have to.
Now, real quick, with Flim Flam that we played at the beginning, what was that? Was that just an amp cranked, or was that?
No, that was special. There's a guy here in the valley named Norik Renson, builds guitars, and he's a great luthier, and he built me a guitar, which I asked my friend to hold on to for a short period, and he was a drug addict, and he sold it for drugs, and I've never seen that guitar since, and it was like my dream guitar, and it was my mistake giving it to him to hold on to, but that is the guitar I used on that record, and that guitar was modeled after Steve Lukather's Valley Arts guitar. So it had Tom Anderson pickups, and it had a Floyd Rose and an ebony fingerboard. It was just about as perfect as you could get for that kind of instrument. And the rest of the tone was that Boss OD-1 distortion and like Boss delay and Boss compression, because this was like 90, this would have been 92 or 93. And so I was using all Boss stuff back then. And then I ran that stuff through a, I think it was a 72 Fender Twin, just all the way up. And so again, like, I'm very fond of...
It's a great sound. I love that
Of blessing the pedals with tube, you know, tube love, if you will.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great sounding lead on there.
Oh, thanks, man. That was fun.
Now, let me go back real quick to that I didn't cover yet. In I just want you to describe the Japanese style, that style of music. Mm. How would you describe that and how did you, you know, in terms of arrangement, production of it?
Sure. I mean, there's lots of different kinds of Japanese music. There's J-pop, which is very well known now to all the Japanophiles in the States. And Gaijin has very little J-pop. There's a couple of J-pop moments, but really what Gaijin is kind of a tribute to this Japanese style of rock, which is very much influenced by American rock, but could never be American rock. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it special. And it's sort of a self-conscious rock and roll. You know, real rock and roll is not self-conscious. Real rock and roll is like dancing naked, and that's why we love rock and roll, because it frees you. It's the slightly more educated child of the blues, and the blues is all about, you know, liberation through surrender. But Japanese rock isn't about that, because the Japanese, for better or worse, are obsessed with perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was always the funny thing for me. They'd hire me to be in these rock bands, and they'd pay me, you know, very handsomely. And they'd, you know, I'd come off stage and they'd count my mistakes every night. And I'd say, yeah, but you know, guys, that's why you have me here. Because you don't make mistakes and your music sounds very sterile. And I'm the gaijin that comes and actually makes it real, because I don't play the same thing every time. I'm actually playing real rock and roll. And you love it because you keep asking me back. And so, you know, a lot of Japanese rock, it's lacking that element. And again, for better or worse, some people prefer that. You know, some people like it when everything's perfect. It's not really what rock's about, though.
Right.
So Gaijin was, that was sort of the idea, was, well, let's kind of Steely Dan this rock record a little bit, and let's put in a healthy amount of culture gap, and let's make sure plenty of things are lost in translation, and we should arrive at a fairly authentic sounding Japanese rock record. You know, it's the misunderstandings, sometimes more than the understandings, that provide such pleasurable results.
Mm-hmm. No, it reminded me of some of the anime stuff, like a little more edgier music, like Akira.
Mm.
I forget who the composer off the top of my head of that, but it had like that type of, not darker, but it had a more complex type of sound. It wasn't like you said with J-pop, where it's, you know, it's lighter. And it's a little more simpler, I think, in some ways.
Yeah. No, the Japanese are just incredible people. And very soulful, you know, in spite of what some people might think. But it's a different flavor of soul.
Right.
You know, it's like if you've ever gone to a real ramen house, you can't say that that culture doesn't have soul. You know, you eat a real bowl of ramen. It's soul food. It's so delicious. Or if you go to an izakaya and you have, like, this wide variety of different foods, you know, it's a very short distance from those foods and, you know, black-eyed peas if you know where to look.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a different flavor of soul, and so you know, it's in there, but it's just not obvious. And the darkness is a beautiful element of Japanese culture. Mm-hmm. They embrace darkness in a different way than we do here.
Mm-hmm.
And I really relate it to that. And and I think a lot of people do here. Obviously, anime is very popular, and there's elements of that all through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting because you can hear the influences from us.
Yeah.
And then they take it. It's just like what we, the Brits, did when they took the blues and then they made it their own and then it became popular. So it's an interesting kind of a cross-cultural thing. But it's the album, and I'm playing the guitar parts here on Gaijin, but the album has a lot of keyboards and there's vocals and there's. Sure. And it's part of that sound. I recommend the album. It's a very good album, and it gives you that feel. If you're interested in that style of music, it's definitely there. But it has the edge, and they're just. It's hard to understand. There's a certain attitude in, I thought, from earlier rock musicians, like from the 60s and 70s. They really didn't care that they duplicated what they did on the album. Every live performance was its unique thing, and they just played what they wanted to.
True.
Whereas you would see, especially in prog rock, everybody rehearsed and played the same notes. It was more like a classical.
It's like orchestral music.
Right.
Absolutely.
So it's interesting, and if you notice in Japan, classical music, that's a big thing there, and they totally get that. They like that structure.
Oh yeah, I mean, I played on Yoshi-san's, five of his records. And then when we got to rehearsals for the first tour, I would start improvising solos, and he would take me aside very quietly and say, I would like you to play the solos that you played on the record. And I said, hey, man, you're hiring the guy who played on the record. Why don't you let me make you some new, exciting solos for your live show? He's like, I don't want them. I want what you played on the record. So I had to go back to my hotel room and transcribe my own solos.
That's crazy.
Which was really, a lesson, because every record I did after that, my solos were a lot simpler.
that's true.
Very obsessed with everything being exactly like the record, which for me is, I have a hard time with that, because I do come from a jazz family, and the spirit of improvisation is vital.
Yeah.
It's in my blood. That's who I am. And so I'd make a fine living playing everything like the record, but in my heart, I would rather create in the moment.
Yeah. Well, also, too, when you're live, it gives you a chance to... You want to be able to express yourself in a unique way of that in that moment. You're in that individual moment. It's not... You're not in that moment 6 months ago when you were recording that. You know what I mean? It's...
Yeah,
I get it.
I won't name the band, but a buddy of mine, we went to a large venue a few months ago to see it, a classic rock band do a show, and I was super excited, and everything was so much like the record that we left halfway through and just went home and put on the record.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's the point? Seriously, what's the point? There's no point for me.
No, that's true.
Because you're never going to get better than the record in that way. So why would you do that live? Why not be present? Why not be here now and interpret it through the lens of what's happening at this moment, rather than being a sonic museum, which to me is just, it's like missionary sex or something. It's like, okay, we're just going to do it the same way every night, and no wonder the marriage failed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so. No, I hear you. Well, and then also, too, when you see a lot of bands now with a lot of samples and loops and stuff, it's even more. And we're going to get
that's
into
a tough
that.
One for me,
But I'm going to play a clip from your group Cast, and that's you and Karma Auger and Nick Sample.
Yep.
The Coriel Auger Sample Trio.
Yeah.
And this has that Wes Montgomery influence, and I think that it's tasty. And I mean, I love what you're doing with the octaves and stuff, and you get this great tone. We're going to talk about that too, because you get what I call the bloom. It's just a little bit of distortion, but it's still kind of a clean sound. This is called The Purple Panther. This is a great killer. Here, take a listen. Thank you. Now that's tone to die for. I just love the articulation and the clarity. And then you punch it a little bit and it just breaks up a little bit. Now, what were you using on that?
That was a long time ago, but I know the guitar I used, speaking of Japan, is an Aria, and they made an amazing copy of a 335 back in the 70s, and any guitar nerd worth his metal knows that in the 70s the Japanese luthiers were making better guitars than most of the American luthiers. Mm-hmm. And so that is a lawsuit guitar, meaning that it was one of those guitars that was so close to its American inspiration that the company got sued and had to cease and desist. But I got the guitar before they got the lawsuit. So that's an Aria, that's a copy of a 335. And I remember I met the gentleman whose last name, I think, it can't be Aria, but he started the company, he's an older guy. And I met him at NAMM a few years ago, and I asked him about that guitar because it was my dad's. And my dad was, you know, highly successful when I was a kid, and in the sense that guitar companies just literally gave him guitars all the time. So many that he just discarded bunches, mm-hmm. and I would just snatch them up, you know, and try them out. Because otherwise they would just disappear. I mean, that's just the truth. And so I snatched up this Aria because he used it on one record and they never used it again. And I didn't know its value. And I, you know, met the guy who started that company at NAMM a few years ago. And he said, oh, yeah, that's like one of the best guitars I ever built. And so, yeah, it's this beautiful old Aria from like 77 or 78. And I think it has my dad's name in the headstock still.
You still have it?
Oh, yeah. I never get rid of that one. And that record, that first cast record, I think we made that record in like 4 hours, so we were working really fast.
So that was live. There's no overdubs. That was
no. That record is a very interesting record because, you know, we're all sons of famous musicians, and it was just a real chemistry thing. We just thought it would be a funny joke if we all got together and played, and then we realized we just had a very natural empathy for obvious reasons. And so I just set up some mics at my studio. I have a studio in Venice Beach. And we just started jamming, and like tunes just poured out. And so I think we jammed for about a week and wrote songs. And then it was like a Saturday, and we came in and we played the songs through once. And we took a break, got lunch, came back and played them through again. And then whatever the best take was of those two ended up on that record. And man, I do not remember what the amp was. I know it would have either been that 72 Fender Twin, because that hangs around the studio a bunch still, or it would have been probably a Boogie DC-3, mm-hmm. which I love. I've used that on a lot of records. But then I cannot remember what my distortion was at that time.
It sounds like you turned the amp up.
The amp is saturated for sure, but it might...
You might have used a distortion pedal? Because that's really smooth.
Yeah, I think...
It sounds like if it was a twin, it sounds like a twin at about 7.
Yeah.
So when you dug in, it...
Yeah, it has that dirt. It has that brown thing that we all love. I know I used some kind of distortion. I just can't remember which one. It might have even been... Boogie made this great pedal called the V-Twin, mm-hmm. which was basically like a Boogie in a box that has tubes in it, and I was using that for a while around that time, and it has this beautiful saturation in a blues mode. It has a lead mode in a blues mode,
right.
So I may have used the Aria through that V-twin in the blues mode, which is very subtle, into like the Fender Twin or the mm-hmm. DC-3 Boogie, and that would have been the sound.
Right.
It's a funny record though, man. I mean, just we made it super quick, and I remember I was working with an artist named Madeline Peyrou. And I'd written a couple of songs with her. And Walter Becker worked on that same record, so I got to hang out with him. And Steely Dan are big, you know, heroes of mine. And I remember I gave him that record. And I remember hoping, like, he would hear it and, you know, ask me to join Steely Dan. You know, it's like that kind of stuff, right? And, of course, I never heard from him ever. But I bring that up because there's a kind of a... It's not, some of that tone reminds me of like those early Steely Dan records, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. kind of a little Skunk Baxter thing.
Well, the thing that's cool about it was the fact that you guys you know, that's I presume that every time you rehearsed it, it was you were improvising, so you were doing it different, except for the basic structure.
Yeah.
But you guys are really tight, and Nick, I think, is the bass player.
Yeah, Nick Sample.
Nick, he's just I mean, you guys are playing the same lines and stuff. That's very. I mean, you guys were obviously synced when it came to playing stuff because you were following each other perfectly.
Oh yeah.
And I'm going to play another clip that shows that, but. The reason I brought that up is because this is, again, a live thing. It's not a processed and, you know, just talking about what you had done with the Japanese stuff and that. I read it on your blog. It's an older blog post that you had done this session, and you had walked in, and I'll let you explain it. And basically, they started manipulating. They were in Pro Tools. I'll let you set it up.
Yeah, I mean, when I first came back to L.A., because I lived here as a kid and I left. Lived in New York for a long time. That's where we made Jazzbo. And Jazzbo was done all live, by the way. Zero overdubs. That was done live to two-track. You know, I came up with that code. Like, you need to be able to play your instrument from start to finish. You need to be able to represent. And then when I came back to L.A., I had a nice amount of session work, and it was really thrilling to go in, learn a song, cut it with a whole band, and it just sounded great. And then, slowly over time, technology kept improving, and the proliferation of Pro Tools and the like made it possible for people who can't actually play to start making superior sounding records, or so we thought. And I kind of lost interest in the recording scene. I got called in to do a very big pop record, and I remember we sat there for 3 days. It was like one of the best bands ever assembled. Mm-hmm. And just the top studio musicians. And I'm not like an A-list studio guy. I'm like a B stringer, you know. But the rest of the band was all like, you know, all the usual suspects. And I just felt so lucky to be in that company. And the pay was very good. And we sat in the studio for 3 days and did nothing because the producer was manipulating like one drum track. For 3 days. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then finally on the third day, you know, he brings me in and I play guitar on this one song. And I do one pass and he's like, cool, yeah, you can sit down. I'm just going to time correct it now. And I said, why would you time correct it? He said, well, you know, it has to be perfect. And I said, well, why are you hiring humans if you want it to be perfect? He's like, that's just what we do now. And I don't, I want to answer this succinctly because I could spend the rest of the interview talking about it and I don't want to. But basically, I'm not very interested in most popular music today because it's not made by humans anymore. And it's sort of like a taste thing. You know, like when you eat like genetically modified foods or something and you know something's not right. You just don't want to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
You just want something that grew in the ground, and you want to pull it out of the dirt, and you want to wash it off, and you want to take a bite out of it. And when I hear a lot of records today, they really sound inhuman to me. And so I very soon after that, I stopped doing a lot of sessions because this became the fashion.
Yeah.
And I produce a lot of records now. When I produce records, more and more, with each passing year, I get closer to where I started, which is, if you can't sing, then I can't produce you. And if you can't play, then I can't produce you. Or I won't.
Mm-hmm.
You know? If you can't play your instrument, then because it's just, there's 1,001 people that are going to make that record for you. But I want to make the record with somebody who just, I'm sorry. You got to be able to play your instrument. You got to be able to sing your song. And if that sounds elitist, then so be it. But all my heroes, that's what they did.
Yeah.
They wanted authentic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all.
Of course.
Yeah, and but even when you overdub, at least for myself too, and I'm sure you do this, you phrase it. You play a piece of it that's a musical statement.
Yeah.
You might not play the whole song, but you play like that lead area or whatever. But it's a continuous thing. It's not if you're going to cut and chop every note. And I've heard people that hire like blues type vendors and then they auto-tune it. I mean, it's crazy.
It's heartbreaking.
It's like, what are you doing? But otherwise to sequence it if you're gonna fight every note and just like pop in every note.
I just say why bother? I mean, it's funny, like I was so critical when I was a kid of intonation issues and timing issues because the technology had not caught up with our expectations, but mm-hmm. now it has surpassed them. And like the other night I was driving home and I heard an old Red Hot Chili Peppers track from the 80s. And, you know, Anthony Kiedis, he's so out of tune, and I love it. Love it, you know. And, I hear the squeaks on the bass, and I hear the drummer, you know, with his imperfect, you know, perfection. I just love it all now.
It's part of that sound.
Yeah, I'm drawn to it.
Let me play real quick just, this is it Lila?
Lila, sure.
Is the name that's pronounced. This is a clip from the group Cast, and... again, the interplay between what Julian's doing and Nick on the bass is just amazing. And again, they're improvising, but it's really tight. Let me play this.
We got a shout out to Karma too.
Oh yeah, no, we'll give him another love.
Just no way you can program
so awesome.
That. And the interplay between you guys is that's the magic. I mean, obviously, you guys just sunk right in there, and you're of the same mind because it's just the phrasing and the articulation. What he's playing behind you and how he's playing, and you're like accenting things and mm-hmm. doing, and then you like well, throw in this chord or whatever, mm-hmm. and it just really works. I mean, if there ever was an argument for live performance and recording. That's it right there. I mean, that really just sets the thing. We're out of time, I can't believe. But before we leave, Lori, you have some announcements of some stuff and also where Julian's playing?
Yeah. Well, I hope Julian will get to play a minute here, so I'll be really fast. Julian and Nick Mancini, vibraphone player from also in L.A., will be doing a joint show at actually on one of Julian's regular nights at Trip Bar in Santa Monica. He has his jazz trio playing every Tuesday, and October 4th is the night that Nick will be joining up, and he just released, actually, his second organ band project. So I guess you'll be doing some tracks off of that album called The Long Game.
So I can't thank you enough for being on the show. We just scratched the surface. We have to have you come back because I didn't even get in. There's so much more stuff. And I had three albums here, and there's like I didn't even get into the new Julian Coryell trio. So we have to have you come back. I'd love to have you come back, and I just thank you so much for being on the show. I have a clip from Goodbye Love to take us out, or do you want to play live?
Let him play. My vote's play.
Well, I don't... It's up to him.
No, I'll play. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's no big thing.
And we're going to let him play out. Everybody have a great week. Thank you so much, and thank you, Lori. And I'm going to let him take us out.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.